Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Cowspiracy, directed by Kip Anderson and Keegan Coon. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Anthony Hamilton, who is a vegan, SWP member and student activist. Now, Cowspiracy is a groundbreaking documentary that contends that industrial animal agriculture is the leading cause of deforestation, water consumption, pollution, and even plays a far greater role in global warming than the transportation industry. Cowspiracy manages to expose the capitalist nature and the privatization of the Western food industry, which seeks to protect private company owners and large environmental groups that link back to Congress.
Do you think there should be any concern of us making this documentary?
Of course. If you don't realize right now that you're putting your neck on the chopping block, you know, you better take that camera and throw it away.
It's an environmental disaster that's being ignored by the very people who should be championing.
Let's look at the fundamental problem here.
No one wants to talk about it.
Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions.
The leading cause of environmental degradation is...
We need to address that as well.
It's not up to the Department of Water Resources.
Hard to actually target, like, one thing.
I don't necessarily know what it is.
There's suppression and mismanagement of information everywhere it abounds.
It starts at the local level, but then it goes all the way to Congress.
When you consider the devastation it's having on our planet as well as the oceans.
And we're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of species in 65 million years.
And they can dictate the federal policies because they have so much political power.
And one of the largest industries on the planet with biggest environmental impact. Trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating.
That's the one thing no one talks about. Everybody goes around that.
Unfortunately, we are no longer able to fund your film project. We had a meeting, and due to the growing controversial subject matter, we have some concerns with Capitol L.
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources, and you have nothing.
A lot of people just keep their mouths shut because they don't want to be the next one with the bullet to their head.
I don't know that I would want to comment on that.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And I must say, I found this documentary to be very shocking, thought-provoking, and disturbing all at the same time. And you really do feel a great sense of urgency after watching this documentary to address environmental issues. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic. This documentary was re-released a few years ago, but it's still highly watched and highly relevant to today. What was your take on it?
Well, very much so, and everything that you've mentioned, that and all the above and more, really. And it's quite an impressive first-time feature for these guys. And what they do, which is really interesting, is rather than going for meat eaters and putting them off, which is the obvious thing, they go for the environmental agencies and groups and basically question them as to why they aren't campaigning about this issue, which is greatly affects global warming. I mean, it's pretty shocking. What they also do is, through humour and sparing shock tactics, get the message across too.
And he's also on a personal journey, as we learn watching this documentary. He gets very involved, and I thought that was a good style.
Yeah, we've seen it with Michael Moore, but here it's less about him and more about keeping on point and on the question. And some of the stuff is really jaw-dropping.
We'll see that a bit later on. And Anthony, what was your take on the film?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it. Like you said, about the lack of shock tactics really then allows you to engage in it without feeling as if you're morally obliged to, you know, have to straight away get behind it without seeing the facts and figures and everything like that. So I thought in that sense, you know, it was quite good. It was very critical of the charities, of the people who are supposed to be doing something about this. It was very critical about the lobbyists as well behind it, trying to show the systematic nature of what's going on. I also do think there were a few problems with it. He does seem to pose a lot of the climate change activists against a lot of what he's actually trying to find out, which I think is, you know, a dangerous pit to fall into. In that he seems to target the people who are challenging climate change already, and the, you know, activists against fossil fuels and things like this, as being part of the problem because they're not acknowledging so much the, you know, the stuff around the agriculture industry. And I think it's a bit of a problem. A better way to do it would be to actually link the two together and say this should be a united fight.
But of course, he implies in the documentary that they're sort of in cahoots now, perhaps behind the scenes with the political establishment, and that's why they're afraid to speak on this issue. But we'll talk about that a bit more later on, as we showed at clips in regard to that part of the programme. So, Maria, if I could just turn to you. Do you think, before watching this documentary, were you aware that the animal agriculture industry had such a profound effect on global warming?
No, I wasn't. And having seen Al Gore's two films, even less so, because he doesn't tackle it either. And in the film, he is the main inspiration for Kip Anderson. And if this is as important, as huge as these filmmakers are saying, and the film is trying to say, then why aren't the likes of Al Gore tackling this or mentioning it, even just one line in his two films?
And Anthony, I mean, before we move on to our next clip, do you think this documentary at least makes meat eaters think twice and think about becoming vegan, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it definitely has that, because it shows about, you know, there's a lot of talk about individual responsibility and things like that, but he does break it down in quite very obvious terms. He uses a lot of nice infographs and stuff, which actually shows your impact on the world, the impact of the meat industry and so on. So I think it does actually, it's really good at exposing that and actually showing people the evidence and letting them make their choice for themselves as well.
We'll have to leave it there just for now.
Clearly, the government did not want to talk about this issue. Their inability to answer, along with the environmental organization's silence on the topic of animal agriculture, made it seem something more was going on. I started doing more investigating on the impacts of livestock and found out the situation was actually worse than I had thought. In 2009, two advisors from the World Bank released an analysis on human-induced greenhouse gases, finding that animal agriculture was responsible not for 18%, as the UN stated, but was actually 51% of all greenhouse gases, 51%. Yet all we hear about is burning fossil fuels. This devastating figure is due to clear-cutting rainforests for grazing, respiration, and all the waste animals produce. This makes animal agriculture the number one contributor to human-caused climate change. But not only that, I found out raising animals for food consumes a third of all the planet's fresh water, occupies up to 45% of the Earth's land, is responsible for up to 91% of Amazon destruction, is a leading cause of species extinction, ocean dead zones, and habitat destruction. Yet, the world's largest environmental groups that are supposed to be saving our world didn't mention this anywhere. I had to speak with environmental organizations to find out why they weren't addressing this issue.
Really, some mind-boggling statistics there. Maria, if we could go back to you, do you think the filmmakers were successful in this film in conveying the threats the environment is under?
I think they were. For me, the most shocking was the fact that Greenpeace wouldn't speak to Kip Anderson, which is just mind-boggling. And why these organisations aren't fighting or bringing these subjects onto, you know, attacking the government over it, but that sort of Michael Moore-ish type sort of assault on the Greenpeace's offices spoke volumes. And then the emails that the correspondence that he received saying, oh, we're not this time, you know, not we can't help you this time. You know, when this is, you know, a great opportunity for them to talk out, you know, to speak out and say something.
And Anthony, if I could turn to you now and to address the issues, the main issues raised in this documentary. Of course, what is the link between the animal industrial agriculture industry and also the impact it has on global warming?
Well, I mean, a lot of what was just shown in that clip there, you know, the deforestation, the destruction of habitats, the species extinction, all of these things contribute in a major way. And if you consider this industry, it is an industry. It has, you know, huge, huge amounts of waste, huge amounts of pollution, huge amounts of taking up land simply to grow crops to feed the animals who also take up land as well. It's an incredibly destructive cycle that actually does, you know, I mean, it was very interesting when he spoke to the Oceana person and they said about ethical fishing and so on. But I mean, when he goes through it in detail, there's not really such a thing as the sustainable fishing which they talk about. It, every which way in which the industry constantly expands is destructive.
It is a myth, that's what he suggests in the documentary, which is surprising to hear. So are you suggesting, is there a link between capitalism and global warming? I mean, do you think it's our over-consumer society that is to blame for all these unsustainable methods we're taking?
Absolutely, and if you think about the entire fundamental point in capitalism is about overproduction, it's about constant expansion, finding new fields and areas to be able to conquer and dominate and sell to people. And if you look at the meat industry, the agriculture industry, it is one of those industries which is just growing bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And, you know, with globalization comes that then domination of the globe with this, you know, huge empire behind it, huge amount of lobbyist money. I think that's, you know, he goes and challenges a lot of the leaders of, like you said, Greenpeace and so on. I think that's brilliant because holding them to account over it really shows the power that this industry has behind it as well.
Maria, do you think the filmmaker puts off people who eat meat from taking part in helping the environment, or do you think he does it in a way that's clever for us to help the environment?
No, I think he was quite clever in the way he put it across, because we've seen in other films, you know, where, you know, you see these animals and the way they're treated and in humane conditions and everything. But here he's showing what the consequences are and the effects to us and to our planet and what we're doing, and it does make you sort of self-conscious about it. And I think meat eaters will think twice whether or not the term vegan is another matter, but they will take a harder look at what we're doing to our planet.
I mean, we're told constantly to use less water, to change our light bulbs, to recycle. And Anthony, I mean, shouldn't the onus be on the people in positions of power rather than the individual to help combat climate change?
Completely. I mean, the idea about just doing small individual things like taking shorter showers and switching off lights and things, while, you know, it is a good activity to get into, it's not going to create the fundamental change which is actually going to save the planet. The fundamental change needs to come from these mass organisations. It actually needs to come from system change in reality, because the way in which this industry is set up, it is to make profit, it is to expand, and it is to not look at the side effects of what they're actually creating, the consequences, which is, you know, constant heating of the globe, constant destruction of rainforests and so on.
And as this documentary suggests also, when you're up against this mass production machine, it's really futile trying to help the environment on an individual level.
Couldn't understand why the world's largest environmental organizations were not addressing this when their entire mission is to help protect the environment.
But that's the thing too, they say, you know, use less coal, ride your bike, less meat.
Yeah. I think they focus grouped it, and it's a political loser. In terms of, because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions, and if they get identified as being anti-meat or challenging people on their everyday habits, that's something that's so dear to people that it will hurt with their fundraising.
They do not want to address the primary driving cause of environmental devastation, which is animal agriculture, because they're businesses and they want to make sure that they have a reliable source of funding.
I had been invited to a meeting with Al Gore some years ago now, and made these methane arguments, and he was really pushed back. And that's just his argument. It's hard enough to get people to think about CO2. Don't confuse them.
I think that the problem with a lot of organizations that are focused and have a laser focus don't go off message because they don't want to piss off another whole group of people that will make their lives difficult.
Maria, so if animal agriculture is a leading cause of global warming, why has there been so much silence about this issue? I mean, do you think, as the documentary suggests, there's a conspiracy or cowspiracy happening here?
Well, clearly something's happening, and there's a lot of invested interest, according to the film, because the fact that environmental agencies aren't taking up the cause, and that comment about Al Gore was priceless. You know, he's in a great position to have included that in his follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth in An Inconvenient Sequel, and he didn't touch it.
They mentioned that in this documentary, yeah. Actually, that even Al Gore allegedly didn't want to go there as a politician. He knew that it wouldn't help the cause.
But you have to make it the cause. That's what I couldn't get my head around, you know. And that's the thing about this filmmaker. He keeps on message, and he keeps telling you this, and he keeps showing you, talking to all these different organizations. You know, I understand lobbyists. That's I would expect that from them, and to a certain extent from the government. But from environmental groups, you know, that was the shocker.
I was very surprised to watch that also. And Anthony, do you think, as the documentary suggests, that major environmental groups are purposefully turning a blind eye to the effects of animal agriculture on the environment? I mean, do you think they have any vested interests?
It seemed that way. I mean, from the people he tried to talk to, it was constantly evading his questions. There were times when people, they just went silent and couldn't actually answer his questions. You could tell that they wanted to say something, but it was as if something was stopping them. And I think, you know, there is an unseen power that lies behind these industries, where that pressure, that level of fear that the charities hold over being able to speak out about it is clearly an incredibly pressing issue on them. And I think at the heart of it, one of the things which someone said in the BT just there was that they are businesses and they have funding. And if you look at Kip making this film, he had his funding pulled halfway through the film because they said it was becoming too controversial. You know, as soon as these people, the agriculture industry, feels as if something is going to crush their profits and stop their profits in any way, they straight away jump on top of it and stop it from happening.
And another
interesting was that he tackles one of the pro-agriculture people and says, have you invested money, have you funded Greenpeace or one of those organisations? And she, like, stops dead and says, I'd rather not answer that question, or something along those lines, which kind of suggests that they do.
It speaks volumes.
Well,
either they plead ignorance or they're trying to hide something. And Maria, one of the other shocking things we find out from this documentary is the food disparagement law, which effectively gags people from speaking out against the animal industry. In several states, it's a law that makes it easy for food producers to sue their critics for libel. So who knew speaking against the beef industry would land you in so much trouble?
Indeed, yes, that's $64,000 question. The fact that they went after Oprah and lost again speaks volumes to a certain extent. And the fact that she was sued along with Howard Lyman, who says in the film that if that had happened now, speaking the truth, he would have been he would have lost the case.
Yes. So he's probably lucky that Oprah was behind him on that.
Exactly, or that the Patriot Act wasn't around at that time. Maybe.
Were you surprised to know this also, Anthony?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the person who was sued as well alongside Oprah, he himself had ran a farm.
Well, exactly.
A massive, massive farm. And it was him who then actually realised what was going on behind the scenes and tried to speak out about it, just speaking the truth. Mm. And straight away it was clamped down on. And obviously he doing that was an individual. Then it becomes the onus of what are these organisations doing actually. They have the clout behind them. They have the membership. They have the power to do something. So it does actually make you think what is going on behind the scenes.
We'll have to pause you there for now.
Animal agriculture industry is one of the most powerful industries on the planet. I think most people in this country are aware of the influence of money and industry on politics, and we really see that clearly on display with this industry in particular. Most people would be shocked to learn that animal rights and environmental activists are the number one domestic terrorism threat, according to the FBI.
And why is that?
It's a difficult question to answer, why these groups are at the top of the FBI's priorities. I think a big part of it is that they, more than really any other social movements today, are directly threatening corporate profits. You know, when we try to find out how factory farms and how animal agriculture is put in the environment that try to claim exemptions to that information, either under national security terms or public safety, trademark issues, business. It's a business secret. We've seen all these attempts to keep people in the dark about what they're actually doing. You know, one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating. Through the Freedom of Information Act, we obtained documents from the Counterterrorism Unit that show they are monitoring my lectures, media interviews like this one, my website, my book.
Are we at risk filming this and showing it?
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources. I mean, it's just overwhelming, the amount of money at their disposal, and you have nothing. And I think that fear is a big part of the tactic as well.
Will is right. I was scared. When I learned about the activists being killed in Brazil, I was disturbed, but I felt removed. But to learn about American activists and journalists being targeted by the industry and FBI, my funding being dropped, I was genuinely worried and hit close to home. Was this why no one was willing to talk about the issue? I decided to take precautionary measures with all the footage I shot.
We also learned from the documentary that at least 1,000 environmental activists have been killed in Brazil over the last 20 years. Maria, we see Kip Anderson becoming increasingly more nervous and paranoid in the making of this documentary because of what he's up against as he digs deeper. Do you think the filmmakers were brave in making this film?
In some ways, yes. Because once you've put your head above the parapet, then, you know, you're in that danger zone. And it's something that's very important and it's critical that people know about it. So, you know, kudos to them and to him to carry on with making this film, because it's such a vitally important subject. You know.
Do you really think that their lives were at risk, or were they dramatising it, perhaps?
It's not for me to say. It's hard to say. The fact that their funding was removed, and the fact that the FBI apparently, you know, targets journalists, isn't a surprise as such. But I don't know that. I'm verdict's still out on that one.
And Anthony, if we hear that according to the FBI, environmental and animal rights activists are considered the number one domestic threat. Why are you surprised to know this?
I was incredibly surprised, yeah. I mean, given how explosive the world has become, given how turbulent the times that we live in are, if you consider, I mean, you know, this film was made a few years ago, but there are still so many other pressing issues, where there are mass movements about it, where there are protest groups, where there's everything. It's a surprise to see environmental activists and you know, activists against the agriculture industry being up there at the top. I mean, a lot of the time these are people who are in small groups until it breaks through into a much larger thing, like maybe the People's Climate March and that sort of stuff. But until that happens, they're very small groups of people, so it is quite a shocking thing to hear.
I want to bring in Donald Trump now as we end near the end of the programme. I mean, he's been criticised for not taking climate change seriously, and he has a record of making some bold tweets, and he's even claimed in one tweet that perhaps China is responsible for global warming as some sort of conspiracy against the US. Anthony, what do you make of Trump's environmental policies?
I mean, I just don't think he knows what he's talking about, really. He has access to a social media account which has possibly the biggest platform in the world right now, and he's able to say whatever he wants, whatever pops into his head at any time without listening to any advisors. And really, it just seems like he doesn't know anything that he's talking about, and everything is always an external enemy. He never does anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with the United States. You know, when it comes to Kim Jong-un and North Korea as well, it's them who are the aggressive ones with the missiles and everything like that. So it's always, there's someone else that's the problem, and it's he's never able to look inwards.
Mm-hmm. Amir, what would you say the ultimate message of this documentary is?
Well, that we should all turn vegan, really, if we want to save the planet. Mm-hmm.
So cutting out meat or eating less is not enough, apparently.
Apparently not.
To reverse the damage that has been caused. Well, I'm afraid it was a really great discussion, but we'll have to leave it there for now. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned. If a person goes to a desert empty of anything and all of a sudden finds a big and equipped building, he would tell himself at the first glance, who has built this building in such an order over here? In other words, he thinks about the creator of this building, and the order in that building is a sign for him to get him to the main skillful builder. This world is also like that building. If a wise person looks at this world and contemplates on that, he for sure will find godly signs in it. These signs will lead the man to the remembrance of Allah. This is because such careful people are passing life in the signs of Allah. In fact, every moment of their lives is with the signs of Allah.
خب چون همه واره در آیه الهی هستند میخوابن آیه الهی.
When they move, sleep, work or walk, they all see the signs of Allah around themselves. Upon reaching such an understanding of the signs of Allah, they will be able to reach to the next level, which is the recognition of the attributes of Allah. Then, through knowing the attributes of Allah, they will find that this world is in order and there must be some duties towards the creator of this world. Therefore, knowing the tests and trials of this world and the hereafter are the results of recognizing the signs of Allah on earth. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Muhammad Mahmoud Khalfan, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, welcome once again to yet another episode of The Bridge, a program in which we try to discuss the different supplications of Imam Zainul Abideen alayhi salam, supplications that have come in the form of a prayer manual known as As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyya. We have been discussing the seventh supplication of this prayer manual, and that is on the dua of Imam Zainul Abideen alayhi salam during incidents of sorrow, painful occasions, and intense grief. We had discussed verse number 7 in our previous sessions, and today, inshallah, we go to verse number 8, which is actually a continuation of the previous verse. Having known that everything is in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's hands, when we say in verse number 7 that none can take back what you have brought about, None can avert what you have directed. None can open what you have closed. None can close what you have opened. None can make easy what you have made difficult. None can help him whom you have abandoned. This is what was discussed in verse number 7. That means everything is in your hands, O Allah. Now that we know this, we are asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for a favor. And as we have in some narrations, that if a person begins with reciting salawat, that means invoking abundant mercy of Allah on the Holy Prophet and his infallible progeny, and he also ends his supplication with the same, and in between there are other supplications, then these other supplications in between also would be accepted. So this is very important to realize, that this is one of the beautiful facilitations of the acceptance of dua. First, let us look at what verse number 8 says, and then inshallah we will discuss on this important phrase that or the sentence which begins with salawat.
فَصَلِّ عَلَىٰ مُحَمَّدٍ وَآلِهِ وَافْتَحْ لِي يَا رَبِّي بَابَ الْفَرَجِ بِطَوْلِكَ وَاكْسِرْ عَنِّي سُلْطَانَ الْهَمِّ بِحَوْلِكَ وأنلني حسن النظر فيما شكوت وأذقني حلاوة الصنع فيما سألت وهب لي من لدنك رحمة وفرجا هنيئا واجعل لي من عندك مخرجا وحيا.
فصل على محمد وآله وافتح لي يا ربي باب الفرج بطولك واكسر عني سلطان الهم بحولك وأنلني حسن النظر فيما شكوت وأذقني حلاوة الصنع فيما سألت وهب لي من لدنك رحمة وفرجا هنيئا واجعل لي من عندك مخرجا وحيا. The translation of which is, so shower Muhammad and his household with your mercy. Open for me, my Lord, the door of relief through your graciousness. Break from me the authority of grief by your strength. Bestow me the beauty of your gaze upon my complaint. Make me taste the sweetness of benefaction in what I ask. Gift me from your proximity mercy and wholesome relief, and appoint for me from yourself a quick way out. So this is basically a very beautiful supplication, one verse, but it has a lot of important information that inshallah we will try to discuss. The first sentence is, فَصَلِّ عَلَىٰ مُحَمَّدٍ وَآلِهِ. Now, O Allah, that I know that everything is in your hands. And the fact that whenever you give grace through the Holy Prophet and his infallible progeny, they enjoy the highest station, which is the intermediary of your grace. They are in that highest level, which actually from which all the beautiful things are given, or the cosmos comes into existence. And anything that we get is through Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad's light. And therefore, it is very beautiful to say that وَصَلِّ عَلَىٰ مُحَمَّدٍ وَآلِ مُحَمَّدٍ. It is as if when you want to ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you are also actually wanting to praise the intermediaries that he has kept. And we must understand that these intermediaries are not separate from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, nor do they have independent existence. In fact, no entity in this world has any independent existence whatsoever. No one has independent, an independent being or existence or entity whatsoever. The only person who is a being in the true sense of the word is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He has infinite existence in the true sense, and no one has any kind of existence. All the other things are His self-manifestations. They are not separate entities, as some people try to understand.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifat As-Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana.
So we are acknowledging the fact that it is through Your mercy on them that we also get a share of Your mercy. So as some of the insightful scholars say, that whenever we ask abundant mercy of Allah to be rained upon Muhammad and his al, they are so gracious in themselves that they never take the mercy for themselves. They always make the mercy flow towards the creation and towards the cosmos, and everybody benefits from the beautiful mercy that flows from their hands. But obviously it originates from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So it is a very beautiful start. And as we said, that it is something that if we start with and end with, then our other supplications will also be accepted. So we say, فَصَلِّ عَلَى مُحَمَّدٍ وَآلِهِ. So shower Muhammad and his household with your abundant mercy. Now when we even say this, as we mentioned in a couple of sessions, and I also would like to stress upon this, that if a person looks at this beautiful sentence, he will come to realize that it encapsulates all the beliefs of a person, the true beliefs of a person about God, about his messenger, about the successes of his messenger, and so on. So it's a very beautiful supplication to start with as we try to ask our needs. Inshallah, we'll continue with our discussion in our next episode. We come to the end of the program. والحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين.
That was the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Khalfan, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
یا سجاد.
European News Bulletin.
From London, hello everyone, my name is Syed Bourza. Our top story this hour. With time running out for a trade deal with the EU before December 31st, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is holding crunch talks with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen over dinner in Brussels to try and break the impasse in negotiations. The two leaders are expected to discuss the major sticking points, including fishing rights, state aid, and dispute resolution. The meeting comes a day after EU chief negotiator Michel Barnier warned chances of a deal were very slim. Wading into the Brexit squabble, Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey has warned that failure to secure a deal would leave more lasting scars on the British economy than the coronavirus pandemic. Let's speak about that with Jonathan Fryer. He is an author and political commentator joining me now. Good to have you with us. Let me begin by asking you the question that's on everybody's mind. Is a deal still possible? Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, seems to suggest that there is a good deal out there to be made.
Well, things are absolutely on a knife edge at the moment. As you mentioned, Boris Johnson is going to have a dinner meeting with Ursula von der Leyen this evening, and therefore there are signs that a deal is possible, but it's not particularly likely at the moment, unfortunately. And in fact, in the House of Commons earlier today, the Prime Minister was really quite belligerent in his stance, saying that there was no way he was going to allow Britain to be ineffectively pushed around by the EU and to be made to follow EU rules now that we are outside the European Union. So it's on a knife edge, but it's not looking particularly good at the moment.
It sure doesn't. We've also heard the German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying they are ready for a no deal as well. Let's also talk about the UK economy, if we may. The government here says they're ready to crash out without a deal. The Bank of England governor, as I just read, begs to differ. Who are Britons to believe, really?
Well, I think in this particular case, they should be listening to the governor of the Bank of England, because what will happen with the so-called no-deal crash out on 1st of January would be that we then move on to trading on WTO terms, which means the slapping of tariffs on all sorts of goods in both directions to and from Britain and the European Union. And some of those tariffs are extremely high, which would make some of the British produce commercially unviable and indeed would disrupt cross-channel trade appallingly. So it's a very bleak prospect indeed if that's what we end up with.
And after this dinner this evening between Johnson and von der Leyen, Boris Johnson is speaking for the UK. What about Ursula von der Leyen? Will she have to take the result of this meeting to the 27-member bloc, the heads of state, and tell them what the outcome has been, and then for them to make this a decision on that?
She will indeed. I mean, she has taken over from Michel Barnier, the chief negotiator, to underline the importance and the urgency of the situation. There is a council meeting of the leaders of the EU27 tomorrow in Brussels, running into Friday, and that's really the last chance for this to go ahead. So what she says, what she tells them tomorrow is are absolutely vital. But it's not just Germany that's preparing for a no deal. Ireland has been doing so for several weeks already, and certainly the mood music in Brussels amongst the EU27 is pretty gloomy tonight.
All right, Jonathan Fryer, thank you very much. Now, UK regulators have warned people with a history of significant allergic reactions against receiving the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for COVID-19. The advice came only hours after two hospital staff members who received the jab on the first day of the UK's mass immunization program suffered an allergic reaction. But both individuals are reportedly recovering after receiving treatment. The UK became the first country in the world to approve the Pfizer vaccine just last week, with care home workers, hospital patients, and National Health Service staff getting the jab ahead of others. On that topic, global organizations say 90% of people in dozens of poor countries will miss out on the COVID-19 vaccine. They say rich nations have already snatched up more than 2 billion doses. That's almost all of the world's current supply. Meanwhile, countries subject to Western sanctions say rich nations are already using their control over supply and demand as a political weapon. Bianca Rahimi has this.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
we set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use our, have our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
These countries represent 14% of the global population, but they have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population five times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst. Inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity. But also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame shifting, and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
All right, let's talk about that story with Dr. Ranjit Barar. He is an NHS consultant, a physician and surgeon, joining me now. Pleasure to have you with us, as always. We just heard Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, speaking of equitable access to everyone, but his country is top of the list of countries that have been hoarding all these vaccines. In his case, enough to immunize every Canadian five times over. Is there a way to ensure that these hoardings won't happen? There's a fair distribution of the vaccines across the world.
Side, fantastic to be back with you. I think this is another classic case of the pandemic holding up a mirror to the globe and showing it as it really is, and the disparity between the words and deeds of the very richest nations. Our governments, you know, the plutocracy in the City of London may talk about human rights normally as cover for a bombing campaign to steal the resources of another country. I'm afraid when push comes to shove, you see the same distribution in terms of energy resources. And really, we have to worry whether these are in fact the best vaccines. I think the fact that the vaccine of Pfizer-BioNTech can only be stored at minus 70 degrees C, the fact that it's so expensive means that it won't be the vaccine that will answer the global problems. And I think it's increasingly likely that the countries across the world will instead look to those more stable and cheaper vaccines offered on a preferential rate, as Xi Jinping said, as a global human good from China and Russia.
Not only that, we have to take two doses of it too, 21 days apart. The global rollout is also being hampered by countries in the West using this as yet another political tool. Your reaction?
It's currently, I think if you look at the global rollout, the fact is that really the only published data for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is a first interim analysis covering only a minority of their 44,000 patients enrolled in their trial. It's a large trial, but it's a tiny number of patients relative to the number who are now going to be injected. So 40 million doses have come to the UK, 800,000 already are being rolled out. I'm likely to be one of the people offered that. The elderly and the NHS are the first people in line. But actually, you know, there won't be enough doses. Even 1.2 billion doses is only enough for 600 million people, a small proportion of the world. But in fact, Saeed, I think the point to come to again and again is that this won't be the vaccine offered to the vast majority of the peoples of the world. And that's probably for the best, because actually those that have been taking it in China, probably a million people, have shown it to have a better efficacy and a better safety profile.
Mm-hmm. And finally, we've also heard of some allergic reactions being experienced by a few who have taken it. Will this raise any further questions about how quickly this vaccine was approved for use?
I think it has done, and you can see that MHRA are trying to do a damage limitation exercise. It is the case, okay, that we will see allergies with almost any medication. Penicillin is very common allergies, but we still use it. So I think probably it's still the case that the benefit outweighs the good, but it's hard to fully assess that when, as I say, and I hate to stress the point again and again, we're talking about a first interim analysis, not a lot of data. And really, I'm willing to participate. I will take the vaccine, but we don't have a choice as to which vaccine we have. But it is really a larger stage in a phased trial, and more information will come out about the safety profile over the coming days and weeks, Saeed.
Dr. Ranjit Brar, an NHS consultant, physician and surgeon, thank you.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Let's see what's been trending in the social media world. Story one. A recent report by the CASA War Project at Brown University in the U.S. state of Rhode Island claiming the number of Afghan civilians killed in U.S.-led airstrikes has increased by 330% since a 2017 decision by the Trump administration to relax the rules of engagement for airstrikes against the Taliban. More now with Robert in Lakesh. And Robert, the U.S. military has refuted this report as one-sided. Tell us why we shouldn't believe it.
Well, what we can see by looking at the statistics and the raw data that we've been presented with is that just last year alone, 900 civilians only in Afghanistan were killed as a result of these airstrikes. If you're going to talk about one-sided, well, we could discuss the U.S. media and how it discusses the war in Afghanistan, which has gone on for 19 years. There's no objective there. It's an unwinnable war. Why are they there? And they get angry when Trump even talks about pulling out troops. But what the real sticking point is here is that we saw under Obama, Obama was known as the sort of drone king because he upped drone strikes by tenfold from what George Bush had done in his days. And of course, George Bush is known by many as a war criminal, and that's what he represents to a large portion of the world. But Obama upped that. From this as well, now we've got a 330% increase last year. Again, 700 civilians just in Afghanistan, just that we know about, having been killed just in airstrikes. And these drone strikes, we know, kill overwhelmingly civilians. And they've used these drone strikes as a means of trying to force and coerce the Taliban into discussions. And I mean, if we're talking about terrorist forces inside of the Middle East, they discuss the Taliban all the time, but then, according to this report, we know that most of the political violence has been initiated by the United States itself.
Well, let's hear some online reaction to this story, Robert.
The first one we have here says it's okay, Biden will go back to doing all the things Obama did that you got mad about Trump doing. Drone strikes, kids in cages, bailouts, etc. The media won't mention it, and we'll see posts this VP appearances on nightly comedy shows. All will be perfect. You can go back to sleep. And we've got another one here as well saying Trump's escalation of drone strikes in Afghanistan, Middle East, and Africa really puts the lie to his being called an isolationist anti-war president.
Let's move on, Robert, to your second story quickly. The UAE importing goods produced in illegal Israeli settlements. Did I get that right?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, this development has indicated to us all and really confirmed that the UAE so-called peace deal, as it was